Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer. I'm back, and thank you to everyone who covered for me while I was on holiday. We are joined today by Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, welcome back. Thanks for being on so recently, and welcome back to the show.
Afternoon, Nick and John, and to everyone joining us. Looking forward to what we can try and understand and make sense of as this new week begins, where we don't have any more public holidays. So let's see what we can provide the viewers in terms of entertainment and analysis.
No, truly a dark period in our history, in our year, when we are not forced to go without public holidays. We're also joined today by John Andrews. John, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Nick. And we've got lots to talk about. So much going on, as usual, in South Africa. So let's get into it.
Indeed. A huge number of stories on the agenda today, and we whittled it down to three, although I'm sure we're going to cover some of the others during the week. The first one I want to talk about is actually podcasts themselves, podcasts like us, which Parliament's Portfolio Committee on Communications has called, the chairperson of the Parliament's Portfolio Committee on Communications has called for an urgent frameworks to regulate podcasts. And this is because of a case where one of the biggest podcasts in the country, known as MacG and Chill, recently came into the limelight for some comments made on that show, which caused a lot of, shall we say, public outrage. The main host of the MacG and podcast, Chill, MacIver Makwevo, is going to be summoned before Parliament to appear before the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Women, Youth and Persons with Disabilities for some comments he made about a celebrity's dating life. The comments were as follows, and they are kind of gross, so I will, if you have sensitive ears, cover them. They were having a conversation about this celebrity, and someone said, "Why can't she keep a man?" And then he replied, "Bro, I'm telling you, man, there's got to be something wrong with her. Maybe her coochie smells or something. You know this happens, man. It happens especially with the hot girls." The deputy minister of that portfolio, Women, Children, Youth, Disabilities, etc., says that they consider the comments to constitute online gender-based violence. And the sort of claim here seems to be that either that these comments were the equivalent of violence against a woman, or contributed in some way to the massive problem of violence of a sexual nature that we have in South Africa. And I think, firstly, there's just so many aspects of this to tackle, and I'm going to start with you, John. But the first part is just that what irritates me about this is that it speaks sort of a kind of puritanical pearl clutching. I mean, you know, these comments are gross. I wouldn't have said them. And if you think worse of MacG for saying them, sure. But this is not a national crisis. And I do not think it is even vaguely reasonable to conclude that this contributes to the massive problem of violence against women in this country. In fact, I would say that we have much more pressing things that this portfolio committee should perhaps be focusing its attention on, such as the fact of how few police officers are properly trained to deal with rape cases, for example. You can focus on more than one thing at a time, but I've seen more fuss caused about this than the absolute torrent of horrible crimes that go on in this country. John, what's your take on this?
Yeah, that's quite remarkable. And I think maybe one thing we can read into this is that a mostly very useless and invisible department has finally found something to do. It's usually we don't really see it. And it's probably not needed as a department. So why does it exist? But we see that this deputy minister now is really going overboard in terms of her response to this. And she was saying that so MacG's comments would be referred to the relevant constitutional and statutory bodies for investigation, including but not limited to the Commission for Gender Equality, the South African Human Rights Commission, the Broadcasting Complaints Commission, the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee, plus then she also sort of threatens with a criminal case of crimen injuria. So it's like throwing everything at this podcaster, you know, because he said some ugly words. It's completely insane. I think, you know, it's very important for people to be allowed to say offensive and hurtful things. It's unpleasant, but that is the point of free speech, right? Why would you need speech to be protected? That's pleasant, that you like hearing, that doesn't need protection. It's the speech that is unpleasant that does need protecting. And my concern here is that, you know, from time to time, we get these, as you say, puritanical reflexes coming out of the ANC, where they want to crack down on freedom of expression. Usually they don't go through with it, and I hope that's the case here as well. But one of my greatest fears is that at some stage they will do it, and we are going to be deprived of things like this most cherished collection of books which I've got, which is Sarah Britton's South African Art of the Insult, South African Insults and the sequels to that. Wonderful books of collections of South Africans insulting each other, often creatively, often in funny ways. And I hope that that never goes away. You know, I hope that people will always be able to offend each other, to insult each other, because, you know, that is, I think, a reflection of a healthy free speech environment. Nick?
No, exactly right. I mean, look, if you think what he said is bad, you know, go say nasty things on social media yourself. Don't watch your show. You know, say mean things to people who do watch your show, whatever. You know, you can even call for boycotts of groups that maybe sponsor him if that's really what you think, that this is a great national crisis. But to throw the entire book, the weight of the state against a podcaster for saying something mean about someone is absolutely insane. And Chris, this part about regulating podcasts, I mean, what, are we going to have a sort of censor who sits around and finds every single YouTube channel that does a podcast and says, well, you see, you were disrespectful about this person and this person, so we're going to fine you. It just seems absolutely insane to me. What's your take on this, Chris?
I wonder whether the people who will be given the position of online podcast monitors, whether that will also form part of the portfolio, the individuals who are going to have to see whether companies are adhering to the Employment Equity Act regulations and those quotas that are now coming into force from September this year. Maybe if we talk about government optimizing how much it wants to be involved in people's lives, this will cover various departments and these sorts of regulations and attempts at regulating free speech. Look, I please correct me if I'm wrong here, either you, Nick, or John, or someone in the comments. I haven't seen this particular deputy minister call out her colleagues in the Department of Police, in the Department of Justice, in other departments that have to enforce the rule of law, where resources are expended in terms of the national budget on protecting South Africans that ought to be used for that. Where is that accountability of one's cabinet colleagues or of those in your department if you are really serious about addressing gender-based violence, especially violence against women and children in South Africa? This is an easy target. I think one can personally very strongly disagree with what was said on the podcast, but it's an easy target from a government point of view, because you can say you're going to hold this person in front of various committees, you're going to throw everything but the kitchen sink at them. But when it comes to the day-to-day work of a government, which ought to have a monopoly on force, protecting its citizens, one can see that the South African government fails by that metric on a day-to-day basis. So it's a useful way for diverting attention and looking like one cares, maybe a kind of busy work. And we have seen this, I think, especially over the last 10 years. It feels like it accelerates every year, where the more things decline from a growth point of view, from a service delivery point of view, you see various ministers and bureaucrats finding positions of outrage or positions of looking like they care and doing something. So they find relatively easier targets. I know it's not exactly this along the same line, but we saw just recently the EFF going to Orania and another Afrikaner community in Pretoria, where all that ended up was a lot of litter being thrown around. There was a video of the individuals trying to tear down one of the billboards, but nothing of actual productive substance happened, where the EFF would do something for the communities and the cities of which they are part of a coalition government, for example. So it's indicative, I think, of when politicians and bureaucrats struggle to affect things that they, how they would in a positive sense, and they find easy scapegoats and things to target and look like they care about citizens of a particular country of which they are a government.
No, I think that's exactly right. This is performative, symbolic politics at its worst. And all strength to MacG, having to endure what I'm sure will be some unbelievably hostile questions from the portfolio committee. Just a reminder that if he doesn't go to the portfolio committee, he can be fined or even imprisoned up to 12 months, which is, you know, shows that this is not a play sanction. This is a real sanction to be called before it. Anyway, John, any final thoughts on this topic?
Well, maybe just the thought that the notion of microaggressions has been one that has been promoted, but I think microaggressions deserve micro responses. You know, so if somebody says something offensive, you know, give it a shrug, you know, that's a micro response, or sort of, you know, raise your eyebrows, that's a micro response. And that's probably all it needs. It doesn't need like a whole deputy minister to be going after this person. That's completely, you know, overkill.
Indeed. And I look forward to being called before the portfolio committee for being mean to Fikile Mbalula. All right. Let's go on to our next topic. And this is the announcement that South Africa is finally withdrawing its troops from the Southern African Development Community peacekeeping mission in Eastern DRC, where our forces engaged the M23 rebel group. This rebel group is very closely tied to Rwanda. So effectively, we were very close to essentially fighting a kind of undeclared conflict, it seems, against Rwanda in support of the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo. All the reporting suggests that essentially what happened was our forces were defeated militarily and were taken prisoner by the Rwandans, who effectively gained control over them, confining them to base and not allowing them to carry weapons. We've seen enormous efforts by the Department of Defense to kind of rush out and claim that, no, this is all nothing to see here. This is all just a setback. We're all just doing a peacekeeping mission and we're going to be withdrawing our forces now. Coincidentally, just after they've suffered this terrible military defeat in which 14 service people were actually killed in the fighting. The withdrawal has begun with 13 truckloads of weapons and equipment and 57 soldiers of the SADC mission, most of whom were South Africans, traveled from their base through Rwanda to Tanzania to be withdrawn from the area. I think that's also significant detail showing just the state to which Rwanda has full control over this entire withdrawal. There are still somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 troops there, most of them South Africans, who will need to be withdrawn, but apparently they will be withdrawn by the end of the month. The Defense Minister, Angie Butsereka, said that the withdrawals are nothing to do with this military defeat, but no, it's all because there's been great forward momentum in the negotiations between M23 and the DRC government. And that the peacekeeping operations have been successful, and because there's all this great work in the peace process, that we're going to be withdrawing. I think that's quite frankly sort of ridiculous. I think that those peace negotiations are essentially the DRC's government suing for peace because it has lost the conflict. And I think this remains a humiliation for South Africa's hard power on the continent. Chris, do you disagree?
I mean, for purposes of debate and maybe more engaging back and forth, I don't disagree with you. So you didn't give me anything there in terms of what I can disagree with in terms of substance. I will say, if it's a withdrawal, then that would imply that the South African forces, as part of this wider quote unquote peacekeeping force, have some kind of leverage or something, some sort of positions to fall back on, or some sort of longer term plan. The fact that we saw from the end of January, when the service members lost their lives, the fact that there hasn't been any real substantive coordination or communication or engagement by those forces in terms of pushing back, that tells me they didn't have a strong base or position to work with in any case. So they were always undersupplied in terms of just basic logistics, equipment. We've seen that reporting come out at various instances, not only in January, but leading up to what happened earlier this year. So I think number one is just, yeah, if you're going to use some of these terms in this analysis, like withdrawal or engagement, you need to have some leverage as one party participating in a military engagement. That's one thing to keep in mind. And then secondly, I think it goes back to the lack of capacity on this, on the part of the South African National Defence Force, where even domestically, if you look at things like resources for helping to control South Africa's borders, helping to implement a presence within South Africa's borders in and of itself, and having that level of security, planning, coordination, you don't see any evidence there to back up that the SANDF could be, could form a solid part of a coherent peacekeeping or otherwise force in any other part of the world. So I think if you just look at the reality on the ground, what Minister Motshekga and others have said, it's just false on the face of it.
John, your thoughts on this issue? What does it mean for our standing on the continent?
Yeah, I don't think it's good for our standing. But it's a kind of an interesting story, because I do think that it's normal for a country to try to put a positive spin on a bad situation. That's not unusual. But you have to try to do it in a way that is credible. You know, even if you're sort of stretching the truth a little bit or finding euphemisms that, you know, soften the impact of what's happened, I think that's par for the course.
Yeah, this acceptable. What the defense ministry has done here is a little bit like the labor minister going out and claiming that we've solved unemployment.
Yeah.
It's just so absurd as to just kind of destroy your credibility completely.
Yes. And as I was reading the story, the name that I was reminded of was Muhammad Said Al-Sahaf. And I don't know if you remember him. He was the Iraqi information minister, better known as Comical Ali or Chemical Ali. Because while sort of Baghdad was being put under the control of coalition troops, he was making TV appearances saying, you know, you're achieving fantastic victories. You know, we've captured most of the American army. We've killed thousands of American soldiers. Even while, you know, in the background, you could see Baghdad was burning and missiles, bombs were raining down on the city. And so, you know, he completely destroyed his credibility, but is famous now, is remembered. And this is kind of at the same level. You know, it's just not believable. What is concerning about it, though, is that this form of dishonesty leads to the necessary conclusions not being drawn. And we sort of, in the main part of the story, we see that they're trying to put a spin on it. They've agreed on a line, which is peace process good, progressing, et cetera, et cetera. That's the positive spin. But in the article, which we sort of read while preparing for this, the really concerning bit comes at the bottom, which is where sort of a senior army official gets asked what the problem was. And he said, well, you know, there were equipment deficiencies, which Chris has also alluded to. Those have been spelled out in a report called Journey to Greatness, which described the type of defense force that South Africa would like to have. Sure, that's fine. But then he says, as of today, if we are given an instruction, we will be able to go anywhere in the world where our political leadership takes us. If they instruct us to say, tomorrow you wake up, you go to the moon, we will find a way of getting to the moon. If the commander-in-chief says, go to the sun, we will say it's too hot. We will try find ways of getting the attire and equipment that will take us to the sun. So this is a reflection of necessary conclusions not being drawn from, you know, what should be a learning experience. And this form of dishonesty in encounters with reality is something that marks our policy environment more broadly, not just in the military sphere. But if you think of things like the minimum wage, and you think of employment equity, and you think of the Expropriation Act, sort of all these things that make life worse for South Africans, and especially for poor Black South Africans, you know, those, you have to confront those facts, because otherwise you're going to continue making, reaching the wrong conclusions and making the wrong decisions. And that is what we're doing here. So this is one example of something that's very typical for South Africa, which is that we sort of stick to interpretations of events that make us feel good, and then stick to the wrong policies that make things continue to be worse. So we're not even letting reality teach us the lessons that we need to learn. And that's quite worrying.
Indeed. I mean, one of the stories we're not going to talk about today, but was on my mind, we were looking at in preparation for the show, was Fikile Mbalula making the claim that the ANC had never supported the VAT increase. Which is exactly another example of this sort of thing of just going, just completely denying reality, just pretending like the observable facts before your eyes are not clearly observable, and that it's what's the phrase that that they use on social media? That is gaslighting, trying to convince you that you're the crazy one, not them. I think the government's response to our shocking defeat in Congo is exactly an example of that. And this defeat was entirely avoidable. Sorry, go ahead. Mm.
Yeah, so just the point that you can escape reality for quite a long time, but you can't escape it forever. So ultimately, it catches up with you, and you know, it caught up with the SANDF in those battles. And in South Africa, in terms of our employment and economic policies, that's catching us up to us as well. It's already started. It's going to continue happening until we change course.
Yeah. Chris, any final thoughts?
Just a very last point to add here, and I might be shoehorning it in slightly, but just on geopolitical matters. So given things changing so rapidly, and I know the easy line has been, oh, it's America first now, there is going to be purely isolationist. I think where it's going is more, it's America first, but not necessarily America alone. And what I mean by that is the US is looking for more engaged, active partners in regions of the world where possible to work on areas of agreement. If you don't have a capable military, regardless of what happens with the trade agreements, investments, other policies, you're not going to present yourself either to the US or to other larger countries, maybe like China, the EU, a bigger bloc, as a
worth viable saying that
regional partner.
On this specific issue, South Africa was on the same side as the US for a change. Mm. The Americans were condemning M23 and the Rwandans. Marco Rubio issued calls for M23 to basically disarm, to respect the territorial integrity of Congo. And you'd think this is maybe a little gap in the door for us to start improving relations to the Americans, but no.
It would have helped you, Roy Falco, that would operate.
Definitely. Doesn't the U.S. back Rwanda? So are we not sort of in opposition to the U.S.
Not in this conflict? Not in this instance, I think. I think while they have some friendliness towards the Rwandans, I think that in this particular instance they have condemned the attack by M23 on Goma and across the east of DRC.
Okay.
All right. If someone knows better than me, perhaps they can correct me on that one, but I'm pretty sure I'm correct on that one. Let's move on to our last story. And speaking of delusional thinking, this one really fits into that theme. And that is that Deputy President Paul Mashatile has been speaking about the proposed 100 billion rand transformation fund. This is this idea that instead of businesses and government giving to, you know, sort of upliftment projects and NGOs and things kind of in a decentralized way, that instead that money will be channeled into a giant fund that the government controls, which it will then hand out to small black businesses. At least that's the theory. Of course, this has raised a lot of concerns about corruption. You know, huge pot of money being distributed under unclear circumstances, a lot of opportunity for stealing. But don't worry, the deputy president has assured us that such a thing will not happen. He said, defending the transformation fund, quote, "We will not achieve an inclusive economy as long as corruption persists, both in the public and private sectors. Corruption hinders the growth of small and medium-sized enterprises by increasing costs, reducing profits, and creating uncertainty. To promote an inclusive economy, we must commit to addressing corruption by strengthening our institutions, fostering transparency and accountability, and promoting citizen engagement. This includes developing and implementing robust anti-corruption frameworks, strengthening our criminal justice system, and encouraging public participation and oversight." Sounds very good, very lovely. Hasn't that been the plan for the last 30 years? We've seen remarkably little of that going on right now. John, what's your take on this?
I mean, sort of just listening to the language that you were reading out there, that sounds very much like speechwriter language. It doesn't look like Mr. Mashatile's own original thoughts necessarily, but I think he, you know, asked to be given a speech. He was given one that sounds vaguely appropriate. Lots of money. Be careful how you spend it. Make sure it doesn't get stolen. That's probably what you should be saying. So here's how you say it. Read out the speech. That's it. But as you say, I think it's completely, you know, not believable. As South Africans, I think we've become very cynical about the mismanagement of public funds because of experience. you know, what we've seen over the last 20, 30 years. And also remember that when there used to be sort of international development funds coming towards South Africa being announced on social media, the comments from South Africans below that were, you know, don't give the money to South Africa, it'll get stolen. You know, what are you doing? It's very dangerous. So South Africans are definitely not very trusting anymore. They don't trust the government to handle big amounts of money responsibly. And that's, you know, without even looking at the sort of, frankly, racist basis of this fund, you know, which is to sort of, you know, benefit people on their skin color. It's just an ugly concept, quite apart from the risk of mismanagement and corruption.
Right. And we know, of course, that the majority of South Africans, majority of Black South Africans especially, will not benefit from this project, that almost certainly its proceeds will be funneled into the hands of those who are already politically connected, much to the against the claims of what this is supposed to do. Chris, what do you make of this? I mean, it really seems to me that the president is sort of... or the deputy president, rather. Maybe this is a Freudian slip that I keep calling him the president. The deputy president is kind of, such a bad track record, with, as John says, you know, South Africans having such a low opinion of our ability to fight corruption. Maybe we should strengthen the corruption-fighting institutions first, and then we can maybe talk about whether we're going to create giant pots of money for the government to hand out to people who are not entirely clear what the criteria is for handing it out to them. What's your take on this?
So the image that comes to mind is, this is like asking the hyena or the lion to guard the meat, to guard the chickens, to guard the, you know, take your pick. Why? What in terms of policy, in terms of legislation, in terms of portfolio committees, in terms of parliament, what has changed since before state capture that would make one think either the policies, the legislation, or the incentives amongst politicians and bureaucrats have changed, but this won't result in waste and corruption across the board? The burden of proof has to rest on those who want to allocate more control and more resources in the hands of the state, whether that is the state directly or in the sort of roundabout way where, oh, it's in partnership with the private sector and it's, you know, it'll be done differently and all that kind of thing. The incentives are still going to be for benefiting the politically connected, those who can extend the most influence in terms of who gets the lion's share of these funds. This would be my argument, regardless of which parties were in the GNU, were in government, and would administer this sort of thing. So because of the policies and legislation that are there, because of those incentives, the closeness between such large amounts of money with a few individuals who would decide where it goes, that to me tells me, regardless of the parties involved, it's going to result in elements of waste and corruption. And as you and John have rightly highlighted, I mean, this kind of thing, it's not going to benefit those who it's supposed to benefit, but I also would argue that's not the intention. The waste and corruption that would result from this sort of collectivized fund, that is a feature. It's not a bug of that sort of arrangement, of that sort of setup. If the parties that be, the powers that be, were truly focused on getting real growth going, anything above 1%, I would be grateful for at this point, given where we are. You pursue different policies. But again, those policies would break up vested interests. And this kind of fund is just another example that protects and will continue to fund resources to vested interests.
Yeah, you know, that money that you as a company are spending on skills development, feeding poor kids in schools. No, give it to the government. We'll spend it well. Trust us. Put in those terms, it's clear how ridiculous it is. John, final thoughts.
Final thought is just to remind ourselves of the NHI, which is, you know, basically the same concept of putting an enormous pot of money under government control and expecting us to believe the promises that it will be cleanly and professionally handled. I would not believe a word of it, not for a minute.
Exactly. All right. That is all the time we have for today. We hope that you found this show enlightening. We will be back tomorrow with the Daily French Show for the short version. And I hope you all have a wonderful day. We'll see you all then. Cheers, everyone.